Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show peeking over the pop culture we all love to love. I'm here in the Los Angeles
Still,
studio.
Yes, 2 weeks in a row. I feel like it's the sign of the apocalypse now.
It's very exciting. Soon our long national nightmare will be over. And with me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are DJ and Professor Oliver Wang.
Ooh, I get to go first? Hi, Guy.
You talked, and so I thought, Oliver never gets to go first.
All right.
Digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. And journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi there.
Hello, Margaret. How's it going?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's fun being in Los Angeles. Every week we start off the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture tastes. This week I want you guys to tell me, is there an artist, musician, director, or writer you didn't care for or hated in your developing years, but learned to love or at least respect enough to admit you were wrong when you got older? If so, what was the turning point when you changed your mind? Winner.
Animated movies? I like cartoons, but cartoons always felt, at least when I was growing up, they were almost for adults.
Mm-hmm.
So I always felt like I was an adult. But animated movies just seemed like a drag. And then when you go, it was always with a bunch of kids and it was yelling and screaming and it was just really annoying. So I never really got to enjoy them because I just didn't care. I didn't want to be around the people that sort of went to go see them.
Yeah.
Being my peer group, being children. And then I actually saw Shrek with a bunch of friends. We got really stoned and went to go see it. And it was just amazing. And I said, I'm on board for Shrek. It has Eddie Murphy. It has Cameron Diaz. It has Mike Myers. And then I saw The Incredibles. And The Incredibles is so super sophisticated and has an amazing story. So now I'm more open to seeing really smart animated movies, but I won't go see, like, drivel.
Margaret.
I think for me, I flipped on musicals. When I was younger, I used to really hate musicals. And I guess I thought of them as being all like My Fair Lady or Showboat or something like that, that just had no connection to my life.
My Fair Lady is an amazing show.
Is it? I don't know. I saw a performance of it once in Chicago and I just like was counting the minutes until I could leave. But I will say I did have a few as a kid that I absolutely loved. I mean, I loved Annie because I'm like at the perfect age
right.
for when Annie the movie came out, and I loved West Side Story.
At our age, there was a thing where, like, being an Annie girl was like being a horse girl. Like,
yes.
It was just like a way of life for, like, some girls, like, third and fourth grade.
Yeah, like, everybody had that Annie dress for a while.
Yeah.
And even though I didn't have, like, curly red hair, I wanted to have it. And I would listen to that record all the time. I could launch into It's a Hard Knock Life right now, but I'll save that for Jay-Z. But, I just, you know, finally when I got to be an adult, I was like, yeah, I should really watch some musicals. I think of them all as just being corny and ridiculous and completely lightweight. And I watched Cabaret and I was like, whoa, this is a very like poignant and meaningful and powerful. But then also the music is stellar. And it finally made me realize, oh, this is why Liza Minnelli's famous. Like, I really had no idea.
Yeah. Oliver?
I read about this a little bit on our Facebook page, but it was really Motown. I think when I was in my 20s, in the 90s, in my militant days, you know, I was on that train of that Motown was basically only for white people. And that if you were really into soul music, you know, you were into James Brown, you're into Stax and Volt. But Motown was just like, you know, it's big chill music, basically, which, you know, in all fairness, it sort of was. I mean, that big chill soundtrack, I feel like really set Motown behind by a good 10 years in some ways.
Well, it also killed the movie musical. I solidly maintain that the nostalgia based 1980 soundtrack is what let us not have movie musicals for 15 years.
Do you think Dirty Dancing also did damage in that department?
I think Dirty Dancing was a beautiful attempt to breathe life back into a dead genre that did okay work. I will always stand by Dirty Dancing.
Me too. Nobody puts baby in a corner.
It is a beautiful film about reproductive rights. Sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no, it's all right. I know. I just saw Dirty Dancing on television the other weekend. And besides marveling at the young Swayze, which is one should really marvel at. I mean, it's such a – people, I think – treat it now more as almost like the meme, right? It's the one line, but no one puts baby. I use that line all the time.
Yeah.
But Dirty Dancing is so sophisticated. And in terms of the sexual politics, the gender politics.
It is.
It's a really great film.
I love it.
My turning point in Motown, I think, probably came, you know, sometime in the last 10 years when I began doing more regular DJ gigs and would play Motown songs. And it's not just that the crowd reacts to it so beautifully, but that, you know, I've learned to appreciate how incredibly well done the production is and how great, you know, practically every Motown song sounds. So I was listening the other day to Ain't No Mountain High Enough, and it's written in by Ashford Simpson. It's produced by Harvey Fuqua. I'm forgetting the other producer. But it opens with these with bells. It sounds like a glockenspiel almost. And I'm just thinking, who there sat down and thought, you know what this song needs to open with? It needs some fucking glockenspiel. Yeah. And it sounds amazing. And so yeah, I've definitely come much, much more around on the genius that is Motown. I feel embarrassed that it took me, you know, that I basically wasted my 20s, you know, not fucking with Motown.
I mean, the sad but amazing thing about Motown is that so many of the artists were sort of like used by machines, but those machines were so good at producing. like they were just like, I feel like when you've got a contract that says that you're cutting somebody out of the long-term profits, it's easier to just sort of treat the singer as much of a tool as the glockenspiel.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, though. I would just say that Motown, you know, Berry Gordy certainly had an eye for talent, and one might argue had an eye for exploiting that talent, too.
Yeah.
But just in terms of not even the singers, not even the artists that we know up front, but the songwriting and production staff that he had working for him throughout various incarnations of Tamla Gordy, Motown, all these other subsidiaries. Every time you hear a song and you look at who the writing credits are and you think back, at some point they probably went through Motown they were a major soul artist in the 60s and 70s. It's just a remarkable stable of talent.
Oliver, do you feel like some of what turned you off of Motown was that the 80s, so many Motown artists were really struggling in the 80s in terms of what music they put out? Like, it wasn't very good.
Nah, I mean, I'm sure that might have been the case, but I wasn't listening to any of this in the 80s anyways. I think for the 90s, because I was such a hip-hop kid, and because so much of hip-hop was sampling Stax and High Records and basically Southern soul music, Motown was not entering into that conversation. And so as sample fodder, and I think that also influenced this idea that Motown somehow wasn't for me or wasn't worth me listening to. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this, I basically blame hip-hop is one of
So many people in the 80s who were, you know, huge singers in the 60s and 70s found a sound for the 80s. And I think this seems weird, but I feel like Michael Jackson sort of helped transition that.
Yeah, but I feel like he was like later. I mean, I don't even think of him as Motown at all.
No. But I'm saying that by him having his success and opening up, like growing into the business and then becoming Michael Jackson, that it kind of gave license for other artists to sort of feel comfortable entering into the 80s and making their music.
I'm
going to
agree
80s.
With Margaret. Like, Michael Jackson was a child full of stem cells and, like, you know, like adapted to the world around him. I feel like there were so many people who were releasing these albums because I, as just a little white boy, very much enjoyed like Motown and that sort of stuff. And then like my aunt would bring me like Aretha is soul, but like,
but Aretha like had a
but
huge.
But she would like bring me Smokey like Robinson or something.
Yeah,
like that.
They
or,
the 80s these, was not doing. So
they would
great.
Bring me these CDs of what they were doing currently, and it was like, I don't want to listen to this.
Right,
this
but
is not
you just
fun.
Want to listen to
but
the 60s.
But see, that's just upbringing because I listened to that relentlessly. Like I heard all of the new Aretha and Smokey, so I've always felt like I was. They never went away.
It's funny that everyone sort of went for a genre and not sort of like a director or whatever. I'm going to go with, I thought about Westerns, I thought about Michael McKean, but I'm going to land solidly on dumb blondes as comedy trope because I grew up just sort of like seeing it in places and being like, I don't want to watch this thing anymore. This is the stupidest thing. Why are we even doing this? This is so stupid. Like, it just seemed to me like the hackest of comedies, a character who was fundamentally unsatisfying. And then I saw, what's it called? The Judy Holliday movie from 1950, Born Yesterday. I saw Born Yesterday. I'm so sorry I did that for this thing that I was supposed to have planned. But Born Yesterday is basically her giving this definitive, amazing role that she had, like, perfected after years on Broadway. They didn't want to have her in the movie because she was, like, a fat Jewish lady. She wasn't that fat. Famously, Louis B. Mayer said, I'm not putting that fat kike bitch in my movie, though he himself was a kike. And then, like, Katharine Hepburn made it her personal duty in 1949 to get Mayer to put her in the movie. And it's just such a brilliant, charming, calculated role. Like, it's not just, ha-ha, this lady is dumb. It is this magnificent, this lady works different from you. Like, and it was just such a revelation that I started looking at I had always sort of hated the stupid, dumb, idiot person in comedy. I always liked sophisticated comedy, and it made me sort of realize the ways that those people can be sophisticated. Not unlike the dad in My Fair Lady, who's pretty fucking amazing.
Well, I'm thinking about, when you say the dumb blonde trope, I'm thinking about, like, Marilyn Monroe doing amazing things with that. Like, in Some Like It Hot, she's pretty outstanding.
But the thing is that I watched that. I watched Some Like It Hot differently after having seen Judy Holliday do it.
So if you had seen that before, you might have just been like, oh, this is so played out.
No, I did see it before. Okay. Like, I did see it before, and I was like, Jack Lemmon's great, but I don't understand why we are appreciating Marilyn Monroe here. Mm. And then afterwards, like, her effervescence and her charm, and, like, especially in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, like, her being such a calculating and focused version of a dumb blonde and having Jane Mansfield just sort of, like, running up against the same challenges as, like, an aggressive intellectual brunette and be shoved aside every time. It's delightful.
Yeah.
Much thanks to Mark Moose Motor on the Facebook group for that question. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to talk about a documentary called Do I Sound Gay? That is not about me when I was... 23. Plus, we'll all be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Winner, what are you all about this week?
Oh, I'm going first.
Margaret, what are you all about this week?
Well, I wanted to touch on the Game of Thrones season 5 finale, because we talked about Game of Thrones when it was first starting the season, and it's been a pretty eventful season in terms of what the fans are thinking about it. I've really seen, like, wildly divergent opinions on the season. So just for my own thoughts about it, I did not feel like they nailed the season finale, and I'm still really mad about Jon Snow.
He's not dead.
All right, let's issue a plenary spoiler alert. If you don't want to hear Game of Thrones spoilers, please go ahead 5 minutes, because Margaret and I are going to talk about this.
Yes, we're going to spoil the F out of this.
Okay, so how did you feel about this? I mean, because in the books, it is a slightly more ambiguous, is he dead or is he not dead? The relationship between the TV show and the books is such a fascinating thing, because you see what matters and what doesn't matter in the books. And he's essentially... all of book 4 and most of book 5 didn't matter, apparently, based on what's happened on that TV show.
Right.
But Melisandre showing back up seems to be a strong endorsement that she is going to breathe life back into him.
Right, that she's going to work some magic on him, because she also had a little crush on him, too.
Yes. I wonder if we're supposed to understand that burning Shireen and that not allowing Stannis to win means that she wasn't the blood of kings. Why did we kill that child?
I know, that was horrible. I mean, to me, like, that, it's interesting because that and, like, the Sansa rape are the two scenes that I think are making people want to walk away from this show. Like, okay, this has finally crossed the line.
How do you feel about the moral bankruptcy of the show? Because so much of what the show is about, Lord of the Rings is throwing you a battle of good and evil.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones is throwing a battle at you that a lot of people think is about good and evil, and those people get killed by people who are better at, like, Game of Thronesing.
Yes.
How do you feel about that moral bankruptcy?
You know, I was sure that after Shireen was burned that they were going to show Stannis, like, triumph. Like, it was going to be triumphant for him, that it was going to actually work. And then when it didn't, I was actually impressed with the show, because they have played that card so many times of, like, there is no moral compass. Whoever does the thing that's bad may triumph in the next show, often does triumph in the next show. So when he, loses in battle and gets cut by, beheaded by...
Brienne,
yeah. I was actually really surprised by that happened. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, as far as, like, the moral question, it's so complicated. I actually don't. The Sansa rape actually didn't bother me as much as it bothered other people, because I thought that it's true to the relationship. It's true to that scenario.
I thought that the Cersei rape last season was a lot more...
Yes, what's worse.
Yeah.
Was weirder.
Are you just running up against a number of characters limit? Like, are you just...
Right.
Because we're at a point where you can't see everybody every episode. And then they always have to, in that, like, previously on Game of Thrones, so much of it now is just reminding you that people exist.
It's true. And they've just forgotten about Bran. Bran's just like out in
Bran
the
wasn't there for an entire season. Like, we spent some time with Theon Greyjoy's sister, but now apparently she doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then so much running around Dorne, and no one understands why Dorne is supposed to matter.
And the Dorne ladies, the woman, I mean, that was the worst line of the whole season, where she, like, bites his ear and says, like, you need bad pussy.
No, it was terrible. And the thing is in the books, at least, the bitches down in Dorne are given these, like, fascinating, really compelling backstories. And you're like, what are they going to do? And then you spend two books not learning what they're going to do. Mm. And apparently, the answer is nothing. Though, for me, there's something kind of exciting about just what... who knows what next season will bring?
It's true. It's a total wild card at this point.
It's pretty exciting.
I do think it's very... I mean, I know this is not a new talking point, but the fact that the show and book are now out of sync with one another, yeah, I find to be... completely fascinating from a narrative point of view.
Oh, absolutely.
Because who gets to decide what happens to these characters?
Well,
and what if the author decides, what if George Martin decides, you know what? I'm going to fuck with people and just kind of, you know, contradict things that have happened in the show.
And he's still feeding them some things that he hasn't written yet.
Right.
Like the Shireen burning was, he was like, this is
supposedly
going to happen in the books, but I haven't written it yet.
Yeah. But what if he just pulls back and like, yeah, psych. Decide, like, she's going to be really major. You guys fucked up.
That would be amazing.
Yeah,
that would be amazing. Also, George R. R. Martin, if you're listening to this, go finish your fucking books.
But did you see his tweet this week?
Don't
which was like the
girls.
Best tweet ever.
What was it?
He said, your tears get me through the winter.
Yes.
And it was just, I was like,
that's
this.
Lovely.
That is lovely.
It's pretty awesome.
Beautiful.
I make wine from your tears.
Oliver, what are you all about this week?
I went to go see Inside Out the opening weekend. And I have to say,
Are you physically capable of crying?
I don't cry very often, actually. It is a limitation on me. Maybe I don't have sadness driving my headquarters enough. I thought it was great. I thought it was finally after the last two Pixar films, which I believe were Cars 2, which was just utter shit, and Brave, which should have been better and wasn't.
Yep.
This was actually the first legitimately great Pixar film since probably Toy Story 3. So it's been a five-year gap. And for most studios, maybe that's not a big deal, but Pixar had such an amazing run during the 20-aughts that just being let down by two films in a row felt like the end was nigh. And I thought, I mean, Inside Out has its fine. Maybe it's not perfect. It may not necessarily be better than, let's say, Ratatouille, The Incredibles, which are two of my favorite Pixar films of all time. But so inventive, and just the world creation of how our brains and our emotions and everything else is supposed to work. I just thought it was such a creative approach, which I really enjoyed.
And it's fundamentally a different movie. Those other movies were adventures, and Inside Out is sort of laying an adventure over a very simple emotional journey. Your daughter's 11, right?
She's 10.
She's 10,
but
okay.
But around the same age, sure.
Several people I knew were sort of like expressing uncertainty about whether they would be comfortable taking a younger child there. What was her experience of it?
I'm trying to figure out why you would not take a younger child there. I mean, some of the jokes would go over their head. I mean, they have a whole gag about deconstruction, and I get that my daughter may not get that, but I thought it was hilarious. So.
Honestly, it was – I disagree with those people, but it was people basically saying this is too heavy for children, which is stupid because the whole point of the movie is that 10-year-old girls need to have the time and space to be able to cry. 10-year-old boys need the time and space to be able to cry. Have you seen it yet?
No,
have
I haven't.
Have you seen it yet?
No. Mm-mm.
You guys are going to fucking love it.
Really? Are you tearing up now?
Yes. It is essentially just about what goes wrong if you don't let somebody have, like, basically in your head, it's joy, fear, sadness,
disgust,
and anger, and they get to run the controls at various points in time, and they keep marginalizing sadness while this girl has, like, a big move, and things get screwed up because
you're not, if you're not allowed to feel sad, then, you know, you're basically repressed. It's by
that
repression.
Sounds great. Yeah, I want
to
see that.
No, it's fair. Yeah. I have to say, I had not heard anyone saying that this may not be appropriate for younger children. That just seems like an insane thing to say.
Yeah. I was a little surprised by it, but I think that we... in this world where we do so many things to protect our children from getting stolen or poisoned, we've gotten to a point where we...
monitor their emotions?
We monitor their emotions.
Right.
I had a friend who described being raised by sort of upper middle class parents as being raised to be a companion animal.
Mm-hmm.
And like an accessory.
Yeah.
Like Northwest.
Like your job is to be pleasant when they're around. And I think that, you know, this really... I mean, the big conflict of the movie is... her mom saying how nice it would be if she were happy during this period of time. And the way that her getting that message kind of like screws her up. And her mom is run by sadness, who sort of like, and not in a bad way, but in a concern kind of way. Like the sadness as sort of like a level of just concern and awareness of others is the. Did you notice that?
Yeah, now I think I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. Sadness was at the helm in the way that joy was at the helm of her daughter. So yeah. That is interesting. I mean, a few random side notes too. The depiction of San Francisco was perhaps one of the least romantic depictions of San Francisco I've ever seen in
that house
in animated
was
film.
Perfect. That street and that house were great.
Right. And I liked it. I'm pretty sure they took a shot at Arizmendi, which is a bakery which I used to go to all the time that serves pizza that does not look like pizza that most people recognize as pizza. And so, you know, to me, it was sort of like the folks in Emeryville having a little fun at San Francisco's expense. But usually in cinema, you see San Francisco as this insanely romantic and beautiful place. And it's like, wow, this place is really drab and dreary. And who would want to live there? Which is... again, to me, a little bit unusual for cinema. So I thought that was an interesting, refreshing choice in terms of the depiction of the city.
Also, making her primary focus girls' hockey.
Yes.
Was just so unexpected and wonderful.
Yeah. I'm there from Minnesota, so.
How much can we tolerate Mindy Kaling voice in this?
It's not that bad because you get so much of Amy Poehler that is by far
great.
The one thing that you're hit over the head with. And I have to say, the casting of Phyllis Smith as Sadness, and Phyllis Smith was Phyllis from The Office, was sort of pitch perfect in terms of just that, like she just sort of captures that like woe is me-ness.
Oh,
and her
yeah.
character is made to look a little bit like her. Like I thought that was fantastic.
I can have a problem in animated movies with casting somebody who has too much cachet, like who we understand too much and it not
like
sort
Brad
of
Brad Pitt.
Yeah, like it doesn't even Amy Poehler here, I was like, I cannot make it this character to some extent. Mm. And as time went on, it got better. But I really felt like Mindy Kaling particularly just so perfectly synced with that identity. It was really nice.
And Lewis Black as Anger is, again, perfect.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to go see it.
Winner, what are you all about this week?
This weekend, this was supposed to be like a Too Many Cooks type situation I just read. But it didn't actually work out that well because Lifetime dropped the ball at Lifetime and they put a billboard up in Sunset Boulevard. But Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig did a Lifetime movie called A Deadly Adoption. And it's completely like turnkey Lifetime movie. It's amazing. Every single trope is addressed. And what people didn't understand is that they thought it was supposed to be funny. Or like sarcastic or sort of
like a parody, satirical.
Yeah, like a parody, but it wasn't. It was a Lifetime movie.
People want their camp underlined.
Yes.
People want their.
Right. And that's what people are so dumb.
Yes.
People are so dumb. Like, I'm mad at everybody that was on Twitter going like, why is this? This is terrible. This is so bad. Like, why aren't they? Because Lifetime movies are inherently terrible. Like,
that's why we love them.
That's why we love them. It's the 20th anniversary of Lifetime. And. Really? No, it has to be more than that. Maybe 30. I feel like it's been on forever. But maybe Lifetime Movie Network. But the movie basically deals with Will Ferrell is like a finance guru and his wife has like a farm stand bakery, Kristen Wiig. And they in the beginning, we learn that they have one child and then she's like hanging out on the dock and then like makes a precarious turn and falls off the dock and loses their other baby and he never gets over it. So a pregnant woman comes in they're looking for a surrogate and the pregnant woman comes in, but she's the twist. She's not really pregnant. And then their daughter that they have now has diabetes. So there's a part where he goes, you know about her ketoacidosis. Like, and he says it in the...
That sounds so awesome.
It's amazing. It's pretty amazing.
I caught maybe 10 minutes of it last night on rerun. And it is satirical. It's just not hitting you over the head satirical.
Right.
Because at one point, Kristen Wiig turns to her, you know, to her husband, basically, and says, you know, I can't have children, which is, of course, something that she would never need to say.
Like, it's like, but, and then he says it too, like, especially with your problem with not having children.
Exactly.
But Oliver,
yes.
You may not have watched enough Lifetime movies to understand how much that does get said.
Oh, okay.
Yes, exactly.
Bad.
Everything has to be telegraphed from 100 miles away.
See, I thought they were just playing with it very subtly, but I didn't realize that's actually a Lifetime convention. So,
Winner and Margaret, do you guys have favorite Lifetime movies?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. Thank you so much for just getting in my head.
What?
Oh my God. It's a woman scorned the Betty Broderick story.
Oh, that's real good.
That is every time it's on.
Is that Meredith Baxter Burney?
Meredith Baxter Burney.
Yes.
She plays Betty Broderick, who basically, look, I'm not a murderer or I don't care about supporting murderers, but look, she paid for him to get through medical school and law school. And he went and got like a younger, prettier version of her and then gallivanted all over San Diego. So she had to shoot him in the face.
Margaret.
I cannot name a single title. I think I always watch them when I'm like hungover and actively losing brain cells, but yes. they're very good for that. But the last one I saw was a woman who, I mean, this is just such the typical Lifetime movie. This is like 6 months ago. A woman who marries a man who is lying about his identity.
That
and
one
he's
is
trying,
on all the time.
Yeah, he's trying to kill.
What's the one where Jennifer Love Hewitt becomes a handjob professional?
Oh, that's a show.
No, it became a show, but was originally
wait,
that's
a show. Like there's a television
there's
series.
Several episodes of this.
I forget what it's called, but yeah,
it had a name like the marriage.
She wasn't having sex. She was just giving handies.
She was just giving handjobs.
Handies,
which doesn't. Who does it? I literally just said yesterday. So, who gives handjobs anymore?
I drove down from the Bay Area on Sunday. We stopped off at a pupuseria. Lifetime was on the television, but there's no sound. And I'm pretty sure there was Winnie Cooper from the Wonder Years. Is this a movie that one of you are familiar
I'm sure,
with?
That's how Lifetime works.
Okay. If you were in an 80s sitcom, a coming of age 80s sitcom, you were in the 90s. You were playing a pregnant.
Was she a woman being done wrong?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Let me make clear that the only way that a Lifetime movie can go wrong is when it believes that it is a light comedy. That is the only situation when you need to run if they are dealing with murder or infertility.
Like
anyway.
Christmas ones. The Christmas ones are the
ones
worst.
Are worse.
But also, just really fast, they're doing a 90210.
Oh, behind the scenes?
Yes.
That's awesome. All right. Because I have to be all about something, all right? Let's get to it.
Okay.
I would first like to say this is a low scale all about, but it did sort of just capture my heart and attention. Last night on Facebook, a photo was posted of basically 15 of the best black female comics in New York right now having brunch.
Are you mad you weren't invited?
Oh, it's their space and I respect that. But it was Jessica Williams, Phoebe Robinson, Tiara Francis, like a bunch of people who, it was just that moment of, we've got Broad City, we've got Amy Schumer's show, why don't these people have a show? And that's not public media, but it should be like, and it was lovely to sort of like see that moment of they are being friends and backing each other up and understand that in an industry that isn't necessarily going to hold open its arms for them, Naomi Ekperigin, so many wonderful people that you maybe haven't heard about, but please look them up, follow them on Twitter, learn a little bit more because they're going to be doing something awesome in the next couple of years. And I'm going to be real excited about it. It will turn a whole new generation of children or little boys gay. but then the main thing was I saw Spy. And we've had a lot of conversation about, like, a lot of times newspapers and blogs have been telling us that movies are feminist. And there's been a lot of pushback from Margaret Wappler personally and from media generally. And I
have tough standards.
I think that there is, like, we've come to this point where anything where a woman kind of acts like a human being is supposed to be a grand feminist statement.
Right.
Spy's so good. Spy is so funny and it's so lovely and that it does have some sensibility of the ways of feminism, of the ways that women are ignored, of the ways that women's abilities are underestimated, of the ways that we expect things from women who look one way and, like, that other women are support characters. And this really is a great thing of support character stepping forward and getting to be the center of the story. And it's wonderful. Like, there's this great Ruth Bader Ginsburg quote, I think it's hers, that women's liberation is men's liberation. And how much Melissa McCarthy being the center of this movie changes the obligations on everyone else and lets Jason Statham have a good time. Let's Rose Byrne be Rose Byrne is so valuable that Rose Byrne has like stepped forward to be like, I will be the pretty girl in these movies that are not about the pretty girl. Like, is so wonderful and so much fun. And Miranda Hart, this super, super funny comic from Britain, who's 6'2 and big and kind of like she's not conventionally pretty. And the question I have known about her since this show called Hyperdrive, which was super, super funny. But I was always like, will she ever get a crossover chance? Will Hollywood ever give this woman a chance? And in this movie, her being the dumpy friend to the dumpy friend gives her just a wonderful and delightful opportunity to prove herself to America. And I could not have had a better time at that movie.
I'm really happy she's a movie star.
Yeah.
Yes, it feels right.
Yeah.
And the thing is that it was not constantly making a big deal about this woman doesn't look like she's supposed to to be a movie star. And it let her be glamorous. Mm-hmm. Like, this is maybe the first movie that we've watched where, like, her character really wanted to get to be a spy who's sexy and at a casino in Rome. And, like, even though her superiors are telling her not to, she goes and gets a good dress for herself and makes herself look beautiful. And everybody else shits on her appearance. Well, Rose Byrne shits on her appearance. But she feels beautiful.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's a functionally good spy movie that also made me cry. I cry at almost everything. You guys are listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this to talk about the new documentary, Do I Sound Gay? And Code Switching.
I listen to Bullseye because I want to feel as passionately about things that I love as Jesse Thorne does. His show's just become essential to me. Just can't imagine not listening.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to Alan Rickman about his new movie, A Little Chaos, and also Die Hard, on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum, with me in the studio.
Oliver Wang.
Margaret Wappler.
Winter Mitchell!
You guys are making fun of me because I'm speaking in just a standard regular speaking voice like a person does. It's super insulting. But we watched a documentary that just was at the Toronto Film Festival called Do I Sound Gay? By a filmmaker. What's the... that was me caring too much about somebody else's awareness or thoughts, so I stopped sounding like
David
a heterosexual
Thorpe.
Man. A filmmaker named David Thorpe made a film that asked the question, why do gay men sound different from other men? And
You just up-talked.
Okay, I'm going to stop
You're
that.
You're up here. You do down here.
Basically, it's him being like, oh, I sound weird and stupid. Why do gay men sound like this? And
the jitney is a nightmare. Get me off it.
And can I stop it? Winter is talking about the West Hollywood jitney.
The
jitney
to Fire Island.
It's basically a documentary kind of exploring a thing that really hasn't been talked about because, you know, until 15 years ago, it was illegal in many states to be gay. So we didn't get to contemplate some of the more refined questions. it was... Like, what did you guys think of it as a documentary, first of all?
I thought it was really strong. I mean, the questions about what it means to sound gay is super interesting. Thinking about that is the one tell that a person might have. And, you know, it's funny. My reaction to it, listening when he goes into the kitchen with his friends and they're making dinner together or whatever, my reaction to it, just hearing these three gay men talking, was like, oh, three gay guys. It's going to be fun. I'm going to have fun with these guys. And so that's my reaction automatically. And I really kept thinking about, what if I was a person or I lived in a part of the country where that sound to me would be threatening? That would mean, like, there is somebody around that makes me uncomfortable. I don't have that reaction, so I just couldn't even
It's such
go
an
there.
Interesting question of... I thought that the film raised a lot of good questions. I thought that the way he dealt with it was a little bit hack documentary of personal journey, though I appreciate it, because it is fundamentally, at the end, asking... why am I mad at myself for sounding like this? Why am I self-conscious? Yeah. It's sort of getting at a little indirectly the deep issue of self-hatred amongst gay men, that, like, we are mad at ourselves for being this thing. And you, like, as one of his friends says to him, like, you come out of the closet, you do all of the therapy and work to just sort of, like, accept yourself for who you are. But now you are ridiculing yourself for, like, the most obvious external tell of what makes you gay. In the documentary, he goes to a couple of speech therapists, one in New York, one in L.A., but who train gay actors to sound less gay. And he works on that. And he talks to gay guys about Dan Savage,
David Sedaris.
David Sedaris. You got to see David Sedaris' husband for the first time, which
that was
very
amazing.
Exciting.
Oh, that was really cool. He was very handsome.
He's not just a literary creation.
But they talk about the fact that they both have gay voices and about how much hotter it would be. Like David Sedaris says, "Oh, this is not what I imagined my perfect boyfriend would sound like." and it is this weird question of like us being attracted to masculinity, but also having these indicators that are the sort of the only thing that we can use to find each other. Like, I always think, like, for gay men, it is an interesting game of camouflage. Like, you grow up. The film also sort of talks about the fact that we do, and like, it suggests that we end up talking like this because we model ourselves after women and fancy people and not just our dads, but sort of like people who seem interesting to us in our different way. But then at some point in time around 7, you learn you're not supposed to talk like that. And a lot of gay guys learn how to hide that really well. But then a lot of gay guys, as time goes on, learn to sort of peacock very well to show off that they are gay so that people will come and try to have sex with them. Because we do not have a distinctive skin color that indicates we are unlike other people. Winner, what were your thoughts?
It's always weird watching documentaries like these because I don't understand where the controversy is, because I'm not a gay person, I'm not a gay man, and because I'm so accustomed to being around gay men that I'm trying to, I looked at it beyond his gay voice. I looked at someone who was lovesick and wanted to fall in love, and so he surrounds himself by all these really beautiful couples. Like, I was loving their apartment. Their apartment was fantastic. But I also felt someone who was like, especially when he talked about being on the jitney going to Fire Island and how everybody was just annoying and obnoxious. But I listened to the context of the conversations. It was a lot of just like catty bitchery. So I think that he was looking at something because he was trying to figure out why he wasn't getting the love he wanted. But he was also trying to see what else he can sort of change himself
One of the primary stigmas
to fit into some role that might make him seem more like virile.
One of the primary stigmas against gay guys is that we are frivolous. Is that the things we were talking about is unimportant, and it is largely us getting
the same attack against women.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the thing about gay guys is we sort of always have the option of turning. People behave as though we have the option of turning it off.
Yeah.
And are always sort of wondering why. Why don't you turn it off? Like, he includes the old Louis C.K. joke.
Which was, oh my God, I forgot how terrible
I forgot
that is.
About it, too. And I was like, oh, not funny.
Not funny.
I would, I wouldn't call anyone a faggot unless they were acting like a faggot. Which a lot of people don't understand the very interesting way that that is used to police gay men out of doing anything culturally or externally that validates the lives that we lead. Basically, if we pretend to be straight white guys, no one is going to question what we do furtively in secret, but that sort of keeps us from being able to bond and work together as a community if we can't identify each other, if we can't be comfortable with each other. Like, we are taught to fear each other in a way that just can't happen.
Like, someone's going to out the other person?
Minorities. Or that somebody's going to... Are any of you familiar with the concept of a Shonda Fertigoyim?
Oh, jeez.
It's a Yiddish term, and it means an embarrassment in front of the Gentiles.
Oh, okay.
And it basically is like, that other Jewish person is going to make Gentiles think poorly about me.
Mm-hmm.
And for gay guys, because we are so disparate from each other, because we aren't able to form communities until we're adults, you do constantly have this like, in what way is he reflecting poorly on me? Mm. Which is one of the reasons that we love these guys who look like molded plastic with no internal lives, because it's like, oh, what a safe person to identify with. Oliver.
So I didn't have a chance to see the doc because I was out of town for the past half week.
Yeah.
I will say, just in terms of the themes that it raises and just the idea of code switching, I mean, this is a huge thing in sociology, certainly. We have a whole kind of division of studies around dramaturgical theory, which is this idea that we are always constantly performing our identity. And so this comes across in a lot of different ways, but obviously how we speak is one of them. And, you know, the idea that there's nothing, you know, quote unquote, natural or organic in the ways in which we use language and our voices as a way of communicating who we are, who we identify with. And I mean, one of the things as an interesting thought experiment is wherever this idea of how you're supposed to sound gay comes from, what if that voice had just been different and it had established a different standard, in which case then every subsequent generation of sort of gay man would have had a different kind of – would have had a different convention to work with. Yeah, there's nothing inherent about the sound that we all expect except that that's just sort of what got established at one point and then proliferated.
I actually – there's been a lot of writing recently about gay culture as being a thing separate from homosexuality and sort of those things not relating. And I just – I'm too – like – functionally, anthropologically, these things are related because they come from an organic experience of being gay. Like, different cultural constructions of what same-sex attraction means can lead to different things. But I do think it goes back to, like, not having a good reason not to identify with women, understanding that you are unlike the social structures around you. So on Pop Culture Happy Hour, when they were talking about NPR voice, Glenn Weldon, the gay panelist on that show, referenced the way that, like, growing up in the Delaware Valley, he saw people on TV who did not have, like, Philadelphia accents and was just like, those people are fancy and respectable. Mm-hmm. I will talk like them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's such a common experience amongst gay guys. And I feel like that is a reflection of not seeing a life that makes sense for you in the world around you, not understanding that your course is just marrying a lady and staying in this town and working in the steel mill.
Well, I was going to say, Guy, to go back to one of your earlier points, that if at a certain point our society evolves where there's no need for a closet and that you can openly identify as being queer, lesbian, whatever it is, without repercussion, then the question is, will there still be this idea of like a gay accent if you can signify those things in other means besides that they're more overt than versus how you talk or, you know, how you upswing your the end of your sentences or what have you?
2 points. First of all, I think we are at a point in time when it's still illegal in 13 or
15. Oh, no, no. I'm not saying we're there yet. I'm saying.
But I just feel like there's been a lot of post-gay writing in the recent past that is desperately premature and a little bit insulting. But we will always be a minority group. Like, the stigmas against being Jewish now are so low, but there is still a way that you have to sort of, like, preserve and treasure your culture because it is exists in opposition to this bigger world of Christmas and crosses and all of that. But that also ignores the fact that, like, gay people have to find each other. Like, just functionally, when I'm, like, everybody says, oh, you won't need gay bars, you'll just be able to go into any bar. Well, even at a point when men don't consider it an insult for another man to hit on them, an insult that they are allowed to respond to by killing them in a couple of states.
Oh, God.
But, like, even at that point, it's just walking into a room of 300 people and understanding there are maybe 4 people here and I'm probably not going to be attracted to any of them. Mm-hmm. We're always going to need our own spaces. We're always going to need a fun periwinkle short that just says to the rest of the supermarket, like, hey, that guy knows what a good time looks like. And, like, how much I feel like also part of gay voice is, as you said, Margaret, expressing to straight men and to women, I'm not a problem. Like, when I'm walking on the street at night and a woman is reacting as though a man is there, I will start singing or I will say something to myself or just in some way try to let her know, hey, lady. You know?
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I mean, I have to say, like, if I'm on a train, and this happened in New York when I was traveling around on the train just going from Manhattan to Brooklyn, like, later at night, and I sat down next to 2 gay guys, and I heard them speaking in, like, just an obviously gay man way, and I was totally comforted, whereas if I had sat next to 2 kind of aggressive bros, I would have been, like, more worried. I would have had to kind of been watching my space.
Winner, talk to us about your experience of code switching, both as a woman and as a black person?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I was trying to be thoughtful when I thought about it last night, but ever since I was a little girl, I sounded like a white girl. And it was a lot of it is because my mom teaches English, and my dad is super nerdy and just very, like, dad. I didn't grow up in a strictly code-dependent if that's the right term. Like, I didn't I grew up in a house where we were exposed to so many different things, and my mom was really worldly and my dad's really worldly, but it just was inherently applied to us that we need to speak a certain way because we don't want to be considered like the people that are from the hood. And my mom grew up in the hood. So when she was mad, yes, we got that. And we got it in spades. And it was one thing that I ignored for a long time because I was like, my mom is so aggressive when she's angry because she's not like that in any other way. She's like, hello, good morning. But then when she's like, look, you better get your ass up. And then I'm like, wait a second, what are you talking about? Like, and so it would always kind of mess with me because I was like, why is she yelling at me? Then when I got older and got used to the fact that my mom code switches and that the code switching applies to us as her raising a parent, that's when I realized, okay, there's different things that I have to do here. But the one thing that I realized when I was getting older and I was becoming a teenager and I was, as I was a little girl, is that when I would speak and I would be in the company of white people, it really made them feel comfortable because then I would get, she's so eloquent. She's so bright. She speaks so well. And it was almost like my mom would get upset about it. And I didn't know why, because I was like, they're paying me a compliment.
Yeah. Right.
But now the interesting thing is that I code switch a lot more now because I have made not an effort. This sounds really cheesy, but once I started really understanding like being the militancy and being like a black woman, now I've never felt more black in the last 5 years of my life than now, is that I have to get in people's face when I have to. And I don't care if I don't sound completely like comfortable for you. I'm always going to sound like a white girl, but if I have to really jack it up and get up in your face about shit, I'm gonna do it.
Well, there's
and I have to do it sometimes because you're bringing it out of me.
There's also an issue of topic editing. Like I feel like, you know, it's not like women in our society use different tones of voice or different in intonations when speaking internally, but I do feel like there's shit that you guys talk about when you're amongst each other that you don't necessarily talk about when you're just around everybody else.
Oh, you mean like calling people, like my mom and dad, and how we call a certain black people the N-word? Yeah, we do that all the time.
Yeah, or I mean, like, you know, just...
But it's like the Chris Rock joke about how there's black people and then there's...
I just think that is the most dangerous way of looking at things. And he, after that, and Chris Rock is like somebody I respect so much, but he did a bit very similar to the Louis C.K. bit about how it's okay to call someone a faggot if they're acting like a faggot. And there is a difference between gay people and faggots. And that's not for him to say.
No.
I'm going to understand that difference.
Right.
But I very firmly believe that faggots are not a person you've met. They're something you think you've seen.
Right.
Like, if you have any sense of humanity about someone, you're going to understand that they are well-rounded. And we use these tools to be able to look at someone who's dancing in a Speedo on the back of a truck and say that that's not a person because he's doing that and he's allowing himself to
that's
be
sexually
objectified. And God knows anyone who's sexually objectified can't be a person. And, like, one time I was having a conversation with a friend about, like, a lot of those guys, like, are lawyers or, like, have real jobs and are just, like, having a good time. And he, like, couldn't wrap his head around that idea that, you know, a person could be faggoty, for lack of a better word, and valuable.
Yeah, it all makes me think of that great Onion headline that's like, gay rights parade sets gay rights back 50 years.
Yes.
You know, it's that same kind of thing where, like, some people just do not want to see that most flamboyant, that most, like, showy side of being gay. Like, they're not comfortable with it. They want the gays to still be, like, behaved.
I just feel like that, and that headline is like over 10 years old and it still makes me mad. And it still makes a bunch of gay guys really self-conscious about liking Pride. And I very much go back to a place of when I was 15, I wasn't hoping for civil rights and respectability. I was hoping for a dude to have his business very close to me. And like, and that we are so self-conscious about that. And we lead such like portioned off lives where, like, that's something you do at a gay bar but not something that, like, goes into the rest of your life, that for one day, in the light of day, we admit that we like vodka and like dudes being naked, and that lesbians like topless women on motorcycles. And we're not trying to pretend to be. It's just the danger of respectability politics.
Right.
Like Oliver, like growing up sort of like with a family that was Chinese, but also sort of very much being in a music world that was about sort of like not whiteness. Like, what was your...
Not whiteness.
I'm using unsophisticated terms.
That's right. That's right. But, yeah.
What was your experience of code switching?
I mean, I think for me, especially even before getting into the kind of the music segment of it, I think for the generation, and I was born and raised in the U.S., so I'm considered second generation Chinese American. And, you know, one of the internal sort of skirmishes that you have in a lot of these immigrant communities is you just don't want to be the FOB. And it's, I mean, I'm not going to say it's entirely parallel to what you're describing. FOB stands for fresh off the boat, which I'm sure at this point we probably already know. But in any case, it's the idea that I want to be recognized as someone who grew up here. I'm not a recent immigrant. I'm not like, you know, backwater or backwards. Like, I get American culture. And I think that whether we realized it in a self-conscious way or not, we were definitely presenting a sort of kind of respectability politics to our non-Asian, basically white folks in the communities where I grew up, where we just didn't want to be confused for them, whoever them could be.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating now is at a time at which, and this, I'm going to bring this back to just the sound of people's voices, at a time in which the Chinese community in America specifically is so diverse because you have people who are from Hong Kong, from Taiwan, from mainland China, especially the mainland Chinese, they speak Chinese differently and you can hear it instantly in their voice. And there's a lot of older Chinese American immigrants who are not fond of the mainland Chinese because they consider them to be kind of these nouveau riche embarrassments. And this, again, based on just the sound of their voice, they already begin to identify and treat them differently. And you see these kinds of internal skirmishes and separations occur as well. And so for someone like me, I was raised to speak English, not in some ways, not unsimilar to Winter's experience. I didn't realize, I only found this out a month ago, but my mom had taught me Chinese from birth until I was four, until it was either a preschool or a kindergarten teacher said, I think it's too confusing for him to have both languages. You should just focus on English.
Ooh.
And so,
because God knows 4-year-olds are terrible at learning languages.
Right, right.
So many Hispanic kids can go back and forth between
yeah,
English
I mean,
whoever
Spanish told her that was
totally wrong.
Yeah,
wrong.
Very yeah. true. But on the flip side, I mean, that's why I, you know,
doing the proud work of American assimilation.
Yeah. And that I'm very articulate, and that, you know, I write and speak well. But I think for me, I was self-conscious about just the sound of my voice and it's unlikely that I would have ever had an accent no matter what, partially because my parents stopped teaching me Chinese at age four. But that was, you know, the sound of how you just didn't want to speak with an accent. And that was the big thing for the people my generation growing up.
I from childhood had like so erred in a direction of pronouncing all of the letters and like over articulation that it was a thing. And I didn't. Other people were like constantly identifying the fagginess in my voice, but I was. Didn't think about that. It's sort of funny that I, as an adult, kind of ended up adopting some of the like less specific pronunciations of peer group once I felt more like I had a peer group to seem less like distant, to like just seems like when I was like 15, it never crossed my mind to fit in because I just wasn't going to fit in anyway. But like as I got older, one thing that bothered me about a sentiment that was expressed in the documentary that kind of bothered me was this notion of gay guys putting it on heavy so that we would be comfortable within this smaller group. And I just feel like it is a thing that is identified by straight people because it seems unusual it seems unusual and unnatural that gay guys are doing this. It must be made up. There cannot be anything organic to our culture or behavior.
Right.
But gay guys will sort of like rearticulate that you're just doing it to fit in, but it's such a small part of your life. There is some element of like trying it on when you're first letting yourself do it, but that's only because you've been stopping yourself doing it for so long that you're sort of trying to figure out, how do I do this? Like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, in the movie, I was just thinking about how his friends tell him that it was college when he first started really adapting that voice.
From the moment he got there till the moment, the end of the semester. Did you notice that?
Yeah. And I think that makes sense because in college, that's what it's about, is about finding your tribe, right? You're like, I'm going to find my people. And then it is it's even more of a beacon in the night where it's like, you know, these are the people I want to be friends with. This is the person I am now. And that's so important when you're in college that you do that. So I can see how to his friends it must have looked like a total performance. But to him, it
that
was
one
like,
girl was really offended by
yeah,
it.
Yeah, she was mad.
She was mad.
It's weird to see someone change. Like, we all know the difference of, like, watching somebody you knew closeted coming out or watching somebody you knew closeted transition. Like, there's a world of difference between that and just having, like, a trans lady show up in your life and be like, oh, that's her.
Yeah.
The thing is anytime anyone ever says Yas Queen to me, it means I am no longer a slave. I live in freedom. And that is beautiful.
Oliver wants to say something.
Well, I was just going to say, it is a performance because anytime we open our mouth and interact socially, we're always performing. The four of us right now are performing. So it's not that it's not a performance. It's just that there's never an authenticness. I mean, everything's authentic. Everything's not authentic. But let's just put it out there. We are always performing anytime we were socially interacting with anybody.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we switch codes just in subtle ways about, like, when I talk to my mom versus when I talk to my husband versus when I talk to my boss. You know what I mean? Like, all of those are going to be different.
Right.
Languages, in a way.
I was just going to say, sort of to Oliver's point about the self-consciousness of it, it was really prevalent when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And it was, the attacks at school were consistent with what you'd expect. I got it from Black women the most, the very women who now follow me on Facebook and Twitter and are just obsessed with me. Yeah, subtweet.
Shots,
you know, fire. It was actually pretty humiliating on a day-to-day basis to be attacked for speaking properly. I never understood why that was like their first initial. There were so many other things that they could have ridiculed me for.
So I'm curious, were you ever tempted to sort of code switch to match them to prevent that?
My cousins did, and now they're crack whores. I mean, like, I didn't. I refused to. I just refused. I refused.
All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. Do I Sound Gay will be available on video on demand starting July 10th. I love vagina.
That was very convincing.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Julie Sabatier, host of Rendered. It's a show about making meaning and breaking rules. We're answering important questions like, can you build a spacesuit in your living room?
I went to my brother's place in Beaverton, and he has a swimming pool, and I pressurized the suit and sat down there underwater for about 10 minutes. The thing that I had built was supporting my life. That felt really good.
What does it sound like when you play a polka record through a styrofoam cup? And what happens when an airport carpet gains a cult following?
Oh my goodness, the carpet has an Instagram.
Check out Rendered now at MaximumFun.org or wherever you like to listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
Oliver is now straight squared. He has an extra 2-year-old at home that just came out of nowhere the minute he said that. Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what is your current jam? Winter Mitchell, what is your current jam?
So Gone Girl premiered on HBO this weekend, and I've seen it probably like maybe 60 times because I'm... Love me some Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
And it's a really good movie, too. So you should watch it. But the score and soundtrack was done by Trent Reznor, who's the lead singer of Nine Inch Nails. And he did the score for this movie, and he did it also for Social Network. And the soundtracks are really great study work music.
Yes.
Like, really strong. And considering that when I was, like, 15, I would do my homework to Nine Inch Nails, now I'm doing my... Work to Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. It's just kind of cool. So this song is called Technically Missing. And, I mean, like, not to give it away, I've seen the movie 40 times. You should too. But this is the song that's playing when it all kind of bridges the A plot and the B plot together, then meets in the middle. The movie's like 2 hours and 20 minutes. So this is sort of comes in about the 45-minute point, and it's just delicious because it's all sort of coming together. Understand, like, when this is on, she's sort of laying out her manifesto, and it's just perfect because she's got an amazing, obviously, Amy is portrayed by, what's her name again? I just watched it for Affleck. Rosamund Pike.
Yeah. She's
so she's amazing and strong as Amy, amazing Amy, and she's just sort of laying it out really delicately. Doing a lot of code switching.
Yeah, this is...
That's a code switch of ramen, that
movie. This still has the Trent Reznor stamp, but it's like really light.
Yeah.
You know, it's like very, very lightly sinister.
Yeah.
It's Trent on Molly.
It's really...
Coming down, though.
Yeah.
Sort of the way he puts things in there, though, like, you know, it kind of goes in a lot of different places and it gets kind of stabby towards the end with a lot of the, like... But I love it. I just think that he's really... His evolution into being... what's the word? He designing music for film. It's been like a really pleasant transition.
A composer,
right?
Yeah, that's always a nice thing to see a rock star get a second life in.
Yeah, his music was super aggressive and like dangerous at one point.
Right, because they deserve continued success as opposed to the rest of us. Famous people should just be able to stay famous.
I mean, it's not easy being an old rock star.
No, it
necessarily.
Is not. I saw Bono 2 weeks ago. Trust me, it does not look
We don't
that
even
great.
Have behind the music for them to do anymore. Margaret, what's your jam this week?
I have a jam from Miguel, and it's called Deal. And this is from his third new album called Wild Heart. And the whole thing is just a really beautifully produced, unusual, like very creative album. It has a lot of like psychedelic elements to it while still staying in this kind of like R&B range. So Deal is the second song from the album. So we'll hear a little bit of that.
I can show you the money if you wanna know how.
I love how echoey it is, and I love the synthesizers too. And I have to say that Miguel is somebody that I interviewed on the red carpet at the Grammys like maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And he stays in my mind as being one of the best interviews I've ever had with someone on the red carpet, which is usually the worst interview because they're nervous, they're not focusing, and you can only ask them like 2 or 3 questions before their publicist comes along and yanks them down the line. But he was just so smart and so thoughtful and really just, I love him. I think he's really intelligent and really cool, and I want him to just like shoot all the way up to the top.
Who was he wearing?
I don't know. I remember he looked good, though.
The Grammys always have the best outfits. Oliver.
I was going to talk about the new Janet Jackson single, but I'm going to hold it off for next week because I came upon this story, I think it might have been in The Atlantic, about brain orgasms by people who just listen to YouTube videos.
Asthma? Are you talking about asthma videos?
Yeah. Which I'd never seen before. I had no idea it was a thing. And
Baby Genius's host, Emily Heller, is obsessed with asthma videos, and she is also a Pop Rocket super fan. And so like it's amazing. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, it's fine.
I just wanted to shout out.
So ASMR, it's ASMR. It stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. And the best way to describe it is that sort of tingly feeling you get in your head when you're getting maybe like a head massage. But people supposedly are triggered. They have that nice little feeling, that brain orgasm as they describe it, which is a little confusing because to me, orgasms are kind of in the brain to begin with. So what's the difference? Anyways, but
maybe for you.
But the videos.
New topic.
Next topic.
The videos are amazing to me because most of them feature usually sort of conventionally attractive women talking just like I can't even do the voice. I mean, I'd thought about this on the spot because
of
the code switching.
It's
the whispering.
It's whispering or watching other people be groomed a lot.
Right.
Or opening packages, right? With like wrinkly.
Yeah. And so it'd be people like doing stuff like this. I don't know if our mics are even sensitive to pick it up, but it's just people talking in a really soft voice and scratching.
Oh, I'm really, yeah.
And and they do this for hours.
Yeah.
I'm just amazed that this thing exists. Margaret, I have to say, side business doing this, you would be on lock.
They
you
should start a vertical on Pornhub for it, to be honest. I don't know why they don't.
I'll just brush the baby hairs on the back of my neck the entire time.
See, Margaret's making fun of it, but that's exactly how they sound.
And what are we listening to?
We're just listening to people do stuff like crinkle paper or like chip away at things.
Oh, you should totally put the curtains, the lady with the curtains.
All right.
Oh, I think Colin's got something
hit it,
for us.
Colin.
How did you know?
How are you this evening?
I called it. Margaret would be perfect.
Yeah. I'm going to start a side business. How
you
rich
should.
Can you get doing this?
Really
I have
rich.
No idea.
There's a whole subreddit that I belong to.
Yeah.
Done.
And just dozens of videos of, again, you know, conventionally attractive women whispering into bi-oral a microphone so that it pans left and right.
Ooh.
And then doing stuff like bubble tape wrapper.
Money.
Dusty Springfield would always make me asthma before I knew what it was.
And to me, this is one of those things that could only exist in the age of the internet. I'm sure the phenomenon pre-exists that, but the fact that someone could produce videos like this for this very specific purpose, which is to get people to sort of mentally ejaculate in their heads by talking really softly into microphones. I find it utterly fascinating. It's amazing. I did try listening to it, and unfortunately, I did not get the orgasmic benefits. I think, like Winter, I needed the old-fashioned way, I guess.
Yes, the old-fashioned way.
You guys are so pedestrian.
Yeah, I know. Typical.
My head did tingle from that lady.
Oh, see? See?
Okay, you guys, my summer jam search continues. I have been incapable of finding the names of the people who suggested these songs, but I have, not incapable, I just didn't try hard enough. I would first like to address Shut Up and Dance as a contender.
Oh, man.
Okay, you have to do it. All right.
It is such a good song. Fundamentally, I'm going to have to say it is too heteronormative for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's too heteronormative for me.
It's focused on forever and like destiny and stuff like that is a little like, that's not like, it's just so 1950s in its construction of relationships. Somebody suggested the song Colors by like Genevieve or Genevieve or something. That's been getting a lot of rotation. But today, we're going to be listening to Peanut Butter Jelly by Galantis, which is fun as hell, very clubby. I drove at night with the moonroof down the other night, and it worked perfectly. I question its appropriateness for the beach, but let's listen.
The vocal effects, not what I expected. It's hot and going all in. Visualize it.
And it's got that four on the floor beat again. So there you go.
I don't understand what these words mean.
Can I seriously just explain it to you? So if you listen to where the drum pound is, one, two, three, four on the floor.
People try to explain this to me. People try to explain syncopation to me. It doesn't work. It's one of the things I'm stupid about.
Just count the rhythm. I know you got rhythm, guy. One, two, three, four. And if there's a drum pound on either, that's four on the floor.
One, two, three, four.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's when people start going one, two, three, four that I don't understand what's going on.
That's tricky business.
Yes. So thank you so much to whoever suggested this. I need to be giving you proper shout-outs. But that song is delightful. I will continue to research. Please continue to make suggestions so that I can make a definitive call. All right, you guys. Oh, and also, let's just do, because a TV show that I worked on is coming out this week. Ooh. So let's just go around and all tell them about the thing of ours that they should know about. Another period on Comedy Central is comes on Tuesday at 10:30 after Inside Amy Schumer. It is a Downton Abbey parody with lots of dick jokes, but I also got to write jokes about hatpin legislation and create slurs against the Mediterranean faiths. So it was super, super fun, and I would like you guys to watch it with the very talented Ricky Lindholm and Natasha Leggero, who are great. But then also, Oliver, tell us about your book.
Oh.
Pitch your book, Oliver.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is like a pitchy portion.
We need to constantly be shilling.
Okay.
Always be pitching.
Making that money.
Yes.
Wait, let's remember. What's the name of the show again? Inside Period?
It's called Another Period.
Another Period.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. Fantastic.
It's a fun,
can't wait to see Inside Period,
and on Comedy
though.
Central.
It's a fun double entendre.
Inside it right I'm now. Inside it right now.
It's on Comedy Central.
And what night and time?
Tuesdays at 10:30. Okay. And it's about essentially the Kardashians of 1902 Newport, Rhode Island.
I'm in.
Yes.
All right. So my book is Legions of Boom, Filipino-American Mobile Dish Hockey Cruise of the San Francisco Bay Area. I've actually been doing a lot of cool events both in L.A. and in the Bay Area around it of late. You can go to legionsofboom.com, and the California Report actually produced a really cool segment about the community of people that I interviewed. And so if you really like radio, and if you're listening to this, you probably do, check out the California Reports. And I was also interviewed on KQED's Forum on Friday, which was really cool because Forum was basically my introduction to NPR back when I was living in the Bay Area in the 1990s. I did not get Krasny. I got Krasny's stand-in's stand-in.
Oh, wow.
But I didn't care because I got to be on Forum, and that feels like a bucket list checkoff right there.
Yay.
Awesome. Margaret.
I have an essay on Bjork that's in a book called Here She Comes Now, which is all music essays about female musicians, and you should order it. It's going to be out in July. There was an event in New York just last week, but there's going to be a couple events coming up in L.A., which I'll definitely tell you guys about.
What are you plugging these days?
Well, in this portion that's designed to make me feel bad, I don't have anything to plug, but I am encouraging everyone to follow my Medium account because it's medium.com/queeneverything because I am working on essays that will lead to something in a year.
Nice.
And I am working on a project that is a visual medium that is on a new platform called We Are 8. And the platform hasn't 100% launched yet, but I'm putting together sort of like a project for them. And I also work day to day, so I really don't have time to be like shilling all my wares.
That's awesome. All right, you guys. No, it's great. You're working on shit.
Yeah. Thank you.
You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winner Mitchell, Margaret Wobbler, and Oliver Wang. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. We post show notes every week on our website. Thanks to Miko1253, Hi Colony Anderson, Skratwidavamek, that's probably something backwards, Kama of, no it's not.
That's Secret World of Fam.
Aaron Lee and E Blank for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. It helps us do better on the iTunes charts. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group and comment on the Pop Rockets page on Reddit. Please let us know about the artist that you hated and turned around about and what work it was that made you turn around about them.
Or genre. I'll just say that real quick because that's pretty much how we all answered the question.
We are a production of listener-supported Maximum Fun, and our producer is the very... I don't have an adjective. Somebody help me.
Luminous.
What?
Stunning.
Stunning and luminous, Colin Anderson.
We made him sound like a new planet.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.